Hey folks, welcome once again to Woodwose Radio. This is your host, Brian. We're here with Joy again to bring you another episode of Tarot Talk. Tonight,
hey, everyone.
Hello, Joy.
Hey. Okay, well, I hope everybody's got their decks out and that they're all sorted out like we need them to be so that we can discuss the stuff. I was just thinking, with Valentine's Day almost on top of us, we're also going to cover the lovers tonight. So make sure you have the 4, 5, and 6 of the major arcana out so that you can look at them, and then the 3s for the minor arcana as well. And I guess we'll just dive right into it. Okay, the first major arcana that we're going to talk tonight about is the Emperor. Like the Empress from last show, not last week, but last show, the Emperor is the King of Kings. He is the guy that is in charge of all the kings, and he's the person that everyone defers to when a king is making a decision. So he incorporates into himself the qualities of the kings from the minor arcana. He is compassionate. He's a warrior. He's also very mystical, but very, very grounded. He is also extremely tight with, not tight, but cognizant of the money and where it's going. He is a ruler. He is the guy that is pretty much in charge. If you want to get a representation in your mind of the type of person that the Emperor is, think of the grandpa who's the head of the family. Okay, not the one, not the doddering old drooling gaffer in the corner, but the one that's active in the life of the family and in the interest of all of the kids and all of the grandkids and all of the great grandkids, and the one who's also giving not only sage advice, but who's also giving direction for things like businesses and life. And that kind of feel, okay? The Emperor himself usually represents an older gentleman, somebody who is in his 50s and up, somebody who's got, you know, the experience of being in charge. And he is represented by, you know, a grandfatherly type figure. In the Robin Wood deck, and I swear we need to start getting royalties from her. We're advertising her stuff so much. We have him sitting on a throne, but it's a throne that's outside. It's not a throne inside of a room. So he is very connected with the area that he is ruling over. Okay, he can see his empire, and he is looking around. He sees what's going on. He keeps in touch with day-to-day life and the outside life. He's also wearing a laurel crown in the Robin Wood deck. This shows that he is victorious and has been victorious in multiple battles, and that he has been, you know, fighting his wars for quite some time. So this is not somebody that you want to, you know, start messing with or screwing around with. The description from the book says, a father figure, secure and successful, a stable, authoritative, powerful leader, a person with the qualities of reason and conviction. Now, what they did not add in there is that he has life experience. A lot of people associate that with wisdom. Some, if you've ever played any role-playing games, paper games like D&D, wisdom is usually associated with the clerics and the priests. It's mystical in nature. But in this case, he has a life wisdom. It is life experience. He has seen the situations that are happening around him before, and he's wise enough to realize that most times, if he doesn't do anything, the situation's going to go away. It's going to burn itself out. It's going to, you know, be gone. And so he doesn't have to take an active role because he is in a position where he knows what's going to happen, not through divination, not through being able to pull from the ethers like the magician does, or because of the secrets that the high priestess has, but simply through having been there and done that, and in some cases burned the T-shirt. This guy is an experienced ruler, and he does know what's going on. Let me see, what else can I say about him? Let's go over to, you know, and, okay, like the Empress, he's the Empress's partner, okay, where she is the grandma who is still spry in her 80s, and chasing cute guys down the hall in a wheelchair and a walker, he's the guy that's being chased in most cases. Maybe not as sexual as the Empress, but he's definitely her partner in that. Let me see.
Well, and I'm kind of wondering, too, the High Priestess versus the Empress. You had Isis Veiled versus Isis Unveiled. Now, I'm thinking that the Emperor then would be kind of the representation of the exoteric in religions, the sort of traditional practice, the external stuff, ritual, going to church and, you know, practicing whatever kind of rituals go along with that.
I can see what you're trying to get to, but in that whole grouping that you're trying to connect with him is actually more of the Hierophant, because the Hierophant is the conformity, and it's the business of the church, not the ritual of the church. The priestess, the High Priestess, is more the mysticism and the ritual of the business of the church, and so too is the hermit. Whereas the Hierophant is more the day-to-day collecting the tithes, doing disbursements, paying the clerks, and the conformity and the material life of the church. Understand?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I've associated them with.
Well, because I was...
No, go ahead.
Sorry, because I was just flipping through Manly Hall's Secret Teachings of All the Ages, and he makes a reference to the Hierophant being kind of the esoteric, mystical tradition within religions. So I was just kind of thinking that I guess that would make the Emperor the external, the exoteric part of it.
I can see where he got that association from, but when you're talking about the Emperor and the Hierophant, you can associate them with Henry VIII and the Pope at the time, where Henry VIII was like, okay, Mr. Pope, I want to divorce my wife, and he said no, and so Henry said, well, up yours, I'm going to create my own religion. Yes, I can see where that association came from, okay, because the secular head of the land can also be the ruler of the church, or at least the secular arm of the church. So that is an aspect that can be looked at. In my opinion, however, and this is just my opinion, once again, come up with your own, you know, associations for all of these. In my opinion, though, that's maybe a function of the Emperor, but it's not a major function. It's something that can jump up if it's saying that this is what is going on while you're doing the reading. But it's not one of the major all the time aspects of the Emperor. Understand?
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. Anyway, since we've touched on the Hierophant a little bit, the Hierophant literally is the Pope. I mean, when Levi came up with the associations, this guy is, I mean, you can't look at the card and think he's anything but the Pope. Because, I mean, he's sitting there in papal robes and in the mitre for the Pope, and he's, you know, in a church. He's got the scepter. He's got the orb. He is the ruler of the church, and the church at the time was the Catholic Church. Ergo, This is the Pope, okay? But like you have a situation where the Emperor card is representing Henry VIII in this case, and the Hierophant is representing the Pope, you also have the Hierophant not only standing for rulership in the church and on a spiritual level, but also the cleric in the abbey who is doing the day-to-day work of the church. Now, they do take care of the poor. They do take care of situations that only the church can take care of, and that's what they're supposed to do. Hang on a second. I'm starting dinner here. And,
no worries.
you know, you have that. It's that day-to-day connection. The Hierophant in the tarot represents conformity and represents a connection to the hidebound. It's a religious. I'm struggling for words here because there's not. You have to get a sense of this because it's not really something that can be well described in words, at least for me. You will do this and you will obey this structure. And if you don't, you're going to be cursed to an eternity of being outside of God's sight. So there's the terror that you get in a religious aspect as well. And like I said, it is very material plane. It is very here. It is very now. Whereas the High Priestess is more the mystic. She's the person that has the ritual. She's the one that has the connection to God and the direct mouthpiece of God, where it's channeled from the deities through her, and it comes out without filtering and without changing. Whereas the Hierophant is, he has a sense of God inside of himself, but, you know, as with anything where you are a representative of somebody else, there's the huge temptation of saying, okay, well, John so-and-so said this, so you have to do what I say because he said so, and if you obey him, then you have to obey me now. And taking that authority that is rightfully yours and divinely sponsored and using it for your own ends. He is, in a lot of ways, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Okay?
Yeah, for sure.
And, I mean, that's really a lot of what the Hierophant is. Any negative aspects of a religious institution that you can think of, from molestation of altar boys to paying off mistresses to using all of the tithe money to buy Cadillacs to, you know, gilding the altar rather than spending it to help the poor and the needy. This is wrapped up in the Hierophant, okay?
And Benny Hinn, for that matter.
Yeah. And I just wanted to mention, I my jaw hit the floor, and I got a big old bone bruise when I read that the Pope was retiring. I'm like, wow. So, okay.
I didn't
anyway,
know the
that
Pope could
aside.
Retire. I didn't know Popes could retire.
Yeah, I didn't think so either. I guess he basically said that, well, I'm the Pope, and I can do what I want, so I want to retire, so I'm retiring. Bye.
How weird. Well, I mean, doesn't that mean that it's going to lead to another of those stupid vote things
another
where they
papal
elect
election?
Another one?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. That's what's going to be winding up happening soon. So
that's
we're going to
so
have the
weird,
white smoke
though.
And the black smoke and the Vatican going crazy and everything like that. I don't know. It's setting a new precedent. But, yeah, the popes are supposed to die in office. And
yeah, really.
And decided not to.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe it's not because there's so much controversy surrounding his particular papacy and, you know, all his past work leading up to it. Because, I mean, he is the one connected with a lot of controversial stuff. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wonder if maybe he just kind of went, you know what, this is just not working. We should probably let me call it quits.
Well, if you want to see it that way, that would mean he actually cared more about the church than his own self-aggrandizement. And that's not the impression that I get from him.
That's fair.
Anyway, okay. yeah, I think it's probably just that he's getting blocked by so many things. I mean, because all of his association with everything else that was brought up, what, 8 years ago when he was elected Pope, kind of disappeared over the intervening time, and now he's, you know, just another person, another Pope, and a lot of people don't ignore him and whatever like that. So I don't know. I think he's just tired. And, you know, hopefully we'll get a more progressive head of the Catholic Church in there. But, you know, it's one of those cases of this is a perfect example of the Hierophant using his power for himself. If Benedict is retiring because he's tired and because he wants to, and there's no precedent for it, and he's saying, well, I'm the Pope, I can do what I want, there you go. The Hierophant encapsulated.
Fair enough.
Okay, and on to the lovers. We've got Valentine's Day coming up in 2 days, and so the lovers card is one of those cards that everybody associates with Valentine's Day. And in a lot of cases, I don't know if it's fairly associated with Valentine's Day. St. Valentine's Day is, you know, from St. Valentine, and we're not going to get into the whole meaning of the day. But what I am going to say is that it's supposedly a day when you express your love for somebody that you care about, okay? In a perfect world, you wouldn't need a special day to celebrate your love for your spouse or your loved one. You would be doing that every day. But American commercialism has, and Western civilization commercialism has decreed that this is the day that we show our love in extravagant ways and ignore them the rest of the year. So the lovers is usually associated with that. I think it is wrongly associated, though, because it is not two people who are in love. Okay, the two people that are in love is the Two of Cups. Okay, the lovers is a partnership, and it's a true partnership. It is one where two people are working together to be greater than the sum of each of them together, okay, or each of them separately. With your partner, you are supposed to be more competent. You are supposed to be better. You are supposed to have all of your locks unlocked with their keys, and you're supposed to have keys for their locks. And you cooperate in this. And when you make a decision, it's not something that just affects you anymore. It is something that also affects your partner. So you would consult with them and say, okay, this is what I'm thinking about doing. And in the times when you can't consult with them and say, this is what I'm thinking of doing, and you just go ahead and make the decision, your partner is also of the opinion, okay, I trust them. They would not do anything to harm me. And they know how I feel on most issues. And so I will trust that their decision is the right one considered at the time that they made it, okay? If you look at the Robin Wood lovers card, you've got two people, they're beautiful people, they're naked, which is, you know, a lot of people relate that to sex, but it's not, sexual union is part of it, but it's not a major aspect of it. But if you look at him, at the people, she is a dark-haired, shortish woman, he is a tall, blonde, you know, Nordic something. But they have their arms wrapped around each other. And one of the things that I remember reading when I was going through the big book by Robin on this is that he's got his eyes closed, and she's looking ahead. They are holding on to each other, and she is leading him. And he is perfectly content to let her lead him because he trusts her. Okay? Let me see. Yeah, and there's the Adam and Eve association also. The innocent, where they are, because they are naked, not even fig leaves. So there's the innocence in a relationship like this as well. It's been associated with me when I was being taught that this is a choice between a sacred and a profane relationship together. But more than that, it is partners. It is two people that are better with each other than they are separately.
Well, and I think with this particular deck, you've got like obviously the sun and the moon, the male and the female. But I noticed too that the two trees are different. There's actually an apple tree and an oak tree, and the apple tree technically would be an association with healing, which mm-hmm. is another meaning of this card. Whereas I guess the oak would represent sort of a more masculine, maybe even, you know, like the horned god kind of association. So a balance between the two. But yeah, again, I mean, the whole dichotomy with the sacred versus the profane too, is something that connects into Tantra or, you know, other approaches to kind of sexual magic or esoteric spirituality.
Yeah, anytime you have esoteric like that, it is it can represent the tantric sex. You're absolutely right on that. I hadn't even considered that one. Good spot on the two trees. I did think, however, that there's with the apple tree, it's another relation back into the Adam and Eve. And also there's youth and age. Typically, with the Oak King and the Holly King cycle, you have the Holly King is short-lived, blooms early, and then dies off, but the Oak King goes on and on and on and on and on. I mean, those things can live up to, I think it's like, what, 500 years or something? 400 years? But the holly trees don't last that long, and apple trees definitely don't last that long. I mean, you can get some old apple trees. You can get 70, 80-year-old apple trees. But that's, you know, a child in comparison to a 500-year-old oak. So you have youth and age. You also have the relation to the Oak King and Holly King cycle. As well. I mean, there's, you know, all those, you've got the association with fertility as well. Let's see.
And I would think, too, that if you're getting a profusion of sort of partnership or balance-themed cards, and then the Lovers comes up, you're dealing with something that's very obviously suggesting a partnership or a new relationship of some sort coming into your life.
Oh, yeah. And remember, this isn't necessarily male-female sexual oriented. This could be a partnership in business between two guys where, once again, it's two people who are working towards the same goals, and together they're more than each individually, okay? So don't make the mistake of just associating these two with a romance. It can also be, I mean, I would, one of the things that I would associate with the Lovers immediately is you watch the cop shows and you have the partners between the two detectives or the two street cops, and they're both watching each other's back. They're both working towards solving the case or whatever, but in every case they implicitly trust each other, and there is a cooperation between the two of them that's you know, the synergy is greater than them by themselves.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, basically you're getting that duality between partners. Sometimes it can imply a good cop, bad cop scenario kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, and something that I mentioned before the show started actually was I kind of was thinking that when you've got, like, if you look at the card numerologically, you're dealing with the energy of a two, which is partnership, balance, you know, that sort of thing, multiplied with a three, which is the card of, like, creativity and communication. So when you combine that partnership and communication thing, what you end up with is a six, which
mm-hmm.
is a lot of what the card represents.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm looking at the reversals for these three cards. One thing that I did want to mention is something else that occurred to me while I was talking. Apparently the last retiree for the papacy was 600 years ago. He just stated he was too tired to go on. And believe me, I can understand, this is a man that's 2,000 years old. It gets
yeah.
to be a whole lot after a while. And the Hierophant is God's representative on Earth. In a lot of ways, the Emperor is God on Earth, and he's treated like God. I mean, he may not be a deity, but he's certainly got the secular power to do any damn thing he chooses to do. So those are a couple of things that I thought about as well. And looking at the reversals, the Emperor reversed would be confusion. It would be obstruction. It would be ineffectiveness, weakness in character. It could also be megalomania, because you're talking about somebody that, you know, has all the power on Earth, and the negative aspect of that is getting such a big head, you know, that you think you're Napoleon, and not realizing that Napoleon had his Waterloo and failed big time. Or, you know, Russia invading into there and, you know, watching all of his soldiers starve and die because he was too stupid to realize that, hey, going in the winter when there's no supplies around and stretching my supply lines out for hundreds and hundreds of miles just is not a good idea. The Hierophant reversed. A foolish exercise in generosity, eccentricity, intrigue, and weakness. Think about all of the good qualities that a pope is supposed to have, that a religious leader is supposed to have. And keep in mind that the pope, at least as represented in this, is also having to be aware of the business of the church. Okay, now think of how that can get twisted into a more negative spin. I mean, I realize that the Hierophant is already a negative card, but when you put an even more negative spin on it, you're talking about bankrupting yourself for people that are unappreciative, not just emotionally bankrupting yourself, but also financially, giving bad advice and knowing that it's bad advice and giving it deliberately to hurt someone, getting, not being strong enough to keep going despite everything. And in some cases, it can also be seen as breaking out of conformity. I would associate that with the reversed Hierophant in a heartbeat, simply due to the fact that if the upright is conformity to how things are and being hidebound, reversing that would be getting out of it and thinking outside of the box. The Lovers reversed, failure, unreliability, separation, frustration in marriage, instability, confusion, and silence. This would be two partners who each have their own agendas and are not working towards each other and not cooperating, trying to make each of them better or make the unit better, but each trying to work for their own self-aggrandizement. And this would be the situation where you would have affairs outside of the marriage, where you would have people who deliberately would emotionally hurt each other simply because they could or for some other reason, you know. So those are some of the things to keep in mind with those. And just as a commentary on Valentine's Day, Personally, in my marriage at least, I don't need a special day to show my partner how much I love her, because I do that every day. Yes, it's nice to have, you know, gifts showing that I love her so much and that she loves me. But more than that, it's the attention, and it's recognizing that they're doing something and acknowledging that. For instance, I said that I would do the laundry tonight while she's asleep, because she does so much around the house on a day-to-day business, on a day-to-day level while I'm asleep, because I work third shifts and I'm up all night. And I sit around usually surfing the internet all night when I'm off, that, you know, I'm going to go do the laundry tonight. I found a 24-hour laundromat. I'm going to do it really late while she sleeps. And she was extremely touched by that. And it's little things like that that show you love people. It's not, you know, a diamond ring that you can't afford or a box of chocolate. And that's just my opinion. It's something that I wanted to throw out there.
No, that's perfectly reasonable.
Okay. Do you have anything with any of this, Brian?
Not so much, no.
Okay. All right. Well, then I guess we move on to the threes. I have these arranged going from left to right as pentacles, swords, cups, and staves. So if you want to arrange them like that so you can look at them, that's fine. The threes relate to accomplishments, okay, or end game scenarios. If you look at the threes as a whole, you have the three pentacles, and that's a guy that's carving things. You have three of swords, which is a big old heart with three swords stuck through it. You have the three of cups, which is a blonde brunette and a redhead all dancing and partying while holding wine cups. And the three of wands, is a guy standing on the shore looking out over the ocean at some boats that are coming into the harbor. Okay? Each one of these can relate to an end situation, okay? The Three of Pentacles specifically is the master craftsman. This is a guy who has done his job every day for the last 30 years. He has gone through his apprenticeship. He's gone through his journeyman state. He's gotten to very, very competent at what he's doing, and he's doing extremely intricate carving with a hammer and chisel, and sculpting a feather as part of a wing. Now, I don't know if you've looked at the structure of a feather lately, but those tiny little ribs would just drive me insane if I had to draw them, much less have to carve them. So you're talking about somebody who is exceedingly skilled in what he's doing. And he's not frowning. He's not impatient. He's smiling. He's enjoying himself. This is a guy that knows he's very, very good at what he does. And he is at the top of his field. So that's an end situation. The Three of Swords, with the three swords stuck through the heart with the rain in the background, everybody associates that with heartbreak. And that's the primary reason, that's the primary association with him. But this is another end game scenario, because at the end of a relationship, you have either a parting of the ways where you're both, you know, tired of each other and you go your separate ways and there's no animosity and no resentment, or there's anger, or there's heartbreak. And in this case, it's heartbreak, and it's pain, and it's emotional pain. The Three of Cups, Party Hardy is my mnemonic for this card. It is time to celebrate. You have gotten through whatever it was that you were doing, and now it's time to get drunk, have a revel, go out, let your hair down, dance, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die type thing. And once again, another end situation. The Three of Wands. The primary association with this one is your ship is coming in, because he's looking at ships coming into a harbor. So the association is what you have been waiting for is now arriving. It has come in. it is your time. And, you know, I can't think of a better association for that particular card except that one. But once again, it's an ending of a situation. You are ending your waiting period. You are now getting what you have earned. Did I lose you?
No, actually.
Okay.
I came back after I accidentally hung up, so.
Oh, goodness, I'm sorry.
No. You remember I told you I was having that kind of day, so.
Oh, goodness, I'm sorry. Okay. Reversed meanings. Three of Pentacles reversed. Sloppiness in workmanship, which would follow with a master craftsman. Somebody that can't do their job right, even though they know how to do it right, would be sloppy. Delay of recognition or recompense, preoccupation with gain at the cost of craft, mediocrity. The mediocrity perfectly explains the reverse Three of Pentacles. I mean, because you've got somebody that can produce, but they're not. Why? Because they don't want to. They're lazy. They're settling for something other than what they could do, because what they could do takes extra effort. Three of Swords reversed. Interesting. The reverse meaning is the same as upright, but not as extreme. So maybe instead of having your entire world shattered because you've had these swords stuck through your heart, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to cry for a day. I'm going to eat the pint of chocolate ice cream, and then I'm going to get on with my life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is a card that reversed represents kind of recovery. It's the end of a really bad situation, heartache, that sort of thing. Apparently, if you're dealing with a reading that addresses health, it also implies minor surgery.
Which would follow with swords, which could be also seen as scalpels cutting into a heart.
Exactly, which I just find kind of interesting.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. There's also a comment in here that says the separation has occurred, but the hurt lingers on. So it's not entirely like positive. It's not like, bam, things are done. It's kind of like you're going through that gradual process of beginning the healing now.
The wistful sadness.
Just, bam, like it's over. You're done. Everything's wonderful. Now. There's also kind of a suggestion in here that says a prominence of threes in a spread suggests a period of personal growth, creativity, expansion, self-promotion, self-expression, popularity, and self-improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there's a very strong yang vibration because it's an odd number.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also accepting for the one, the first prime number.
True.
So that association too, if you're doing, if you're associating it with numerology, you know, and the threes are always a powerful number anyway, because a pyramid, a triangle, is a lot more strong and a lot more stable than a square or just a single line. So you've got that too. Three of Chalices, Three of Cups, reversed. Gluttony, overindulgence, and delay. Abundance turns to lack, pleasure to pain, talents are hidden or unappreciated. Once again, this is a situation where you have the maniates, or the meanets, or however you pronounce that, the crazy, blood-sucking, flesh-eating women who got drunk and just went crazy. You've got that association with them because in the Robin Wood deck, once again, you've got three women and they're partying and they're dancing around. Well, if you go too far with that, wine turns into insanity, as shown by, you know, Dionysus and his dual nature. And so you've got that association as well.
Well, it makes me think, that upright, the Three of Cups, represents kind of a sort of Apollonian approach to celebrating, where it's all very up and up, you know, everyone's keeping their cool, they're not getting all wasted and, like, ridiculous. And then, you've got the reverse, which is the Dionysian approach, and, you know, this is where everyone's just getting completely wasted. There's, like, sex and drugs and all kinds of craziness at the party, and, you know, the police are being called because of noise complaints. You know, and, I mean, the card itself represents kind of harmful excess. So, you know, yeah, so you're getting that vibe of the police being called on the party, or, you know, that extreme maniac approach to the party where, you know, the women are just wasted and screwing everybody and eating them and, you know, whatnot.
Yeah. Oh, there is that. I don't know. Apollonian, a controlled party, yes, where it's not to excess, but there's still the letting the hair down and relaxing, which I guess could be seen as Apollonian.
Yeah, it's kind of the office Christmas party sort of a thing where it's reserved. I mean, people are kind of chilling out, but not letting it all hang out because, you know, there's still that need for some degree of, you know,
of getting, you know, getting your release. Okay, and the Three of Wands, in the pagan tarot at least, the upright is interesting. It's a little bit different. Instead of your ship coming in, it's good business, strength, and a grasp of the future, things needed for growth. So the Three of Wands, I got to get a consistent way of saying these. Three of Wands is more a business card. And with the Robin Wood, I can see that. But reversed, it's bad business, failed business, poor grasp of the future. But it's more along the lines of you made bad business choices in the past or in the near past, and now that's coming home to bite you in the butt. And once again, it's an end result of a situation that started a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Now, let's see. In the Celtic Tarot, let's see, what else do they have to talk about? The Emperor... Oh, this is a good one. The Emperor in the Celtic Tarot is represented by the Doida. The Doida, I don't know if a lot of people know of him, but he was a major player in the Second Battle of Moytura. He's the one that had sex with the Mordigan and caused her to prophesy. But more than that, he also went into the camp of the enemy, the Formori, and were delaying them and distracting them while the rest of the Tuatha De Danann were getting prepared. And one of the things that the Formorians tried to do to humiliate him was to make him massively overeat, and he did. They essentially dug a pit in the ground. It doesn't say how big the pit is, but the implication is that it was really, really big, and filled it with all kinds of meats, all kinds of grains, all kinds of food, water, mead, milk, and mixed it all together into this huge porridge and told them that he either ate it all or they would kill him. Well, he managed to eat it all. And as a result, he looked absolutely ridiculous. His belly was distended. According to some of the myths, it was dragging on the ground, and he needed a wheelbarrow. He couldn't pick up his club to carry it along with him, so it was dragging on the ground behind him. But he delayed the Formorians enough that the rest of the Tuatha De Danann were able to get into position and get everything prepared for the Formorians to invade. And take the field against them. So they were prepared because he had a delaying action. And once again, this is, you know, something that an emperor would do. He's not only a ruler of men, but he's also the sacrificial person, because anybody less than that would have made them, the Formorians, ignore them or just kill them outright. But he's too important to kill outright, so they just humiliated him in front of his people, you know, and most emperors are going to go, screw that, I'm not going to do that, that's going to, you know, make me look ridiculous in front of all these people. But he was willing to do that so that the end goal was accomplished. The Hierophant in the Celtic Tarot is very, very interesting. And I can see the association immediately. It's Dansiet. Dansiet is the healer of the Tuatha De Danann. He's the one that crafted the silver arm for one of the rulers who had it chopped off in the first battle of Mortora. Who? Nuada, yes. Nuada, the silver arm. He crafted the arm because he couldn't fix his arm once it was removed. But Dansiet's known for killing his own children, who were also healers. Dansiet was the healer, like I said, the healer of the Tuatha De Danann, and he was extremely good, but not perfect. His son, let's see, with the Sons of Fountain of no, okay, his son, whose name I can't remember right now, actually surpassed him in ability and was able to heal any wound, no matter how severe, as long as it didn't sever the spine. And he was able to regrow limbs on people that were injured in battle. Well, this made Dansiet very angry, and he wound up smashing his son's head open in a fit of rage one day. Well, that naturally killed him. So, as you can see, the relationship with how sticking with what you know and what is now and what you have now is more important than moving on through the future. He also, Dansiet also, his daughter wound up finding a whole bunch of herbs that were growing out of her brother's body after he had started decaying and everything, and she found all of these herbs and medicinal plants and everything and started arranging them in order of usefulness. And Dansiet came along and saw what she was doing, and she had completed her task, and that if they were used in the order that she had laid them out in, mankind would become immortal. So he kicked them all up and scattered them everywhere so that mankind couldn't become immortal. So we have him to thank for that, too. Then the lovers is Ilantha and Eri. Let's see. I don't want to tell Eri her name, but she demanded a pledge of his love, gave her a golden ring when it was not enough for her, so Ilantha revealed his name and his long lineage. I honestly am not familiar with that story. Are you?
No, not at all. Okay. I've not really been focused on the Irish mythology at all.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that we're going to get some calls or emails from people who are talking about, oh, well, it's this story and that story, and that might be a good thing.
Yeah,
but
by
anyway,
all means, folks, don't be afraid to call in tonight or email us or, you know, what have you, to correct us if you happen to know particular details on mythology that we bring up that are wrong, or, you know, whatever. I mean, we want this to be an interactive show, folks, so by all means, if you want a reading tonight, give us a call.
Please.
Number is 646-564-9966. But I think what I'll do right now is play a couple of songs so that Joy and I can take a break from talking live on the air.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So, let's see.
Okay, well, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the music. We're going to try not to fill up the entire show with various songs and such, but one thing I did want to mention, and I kept reminding myself of it like six or seven times when I was planning the show this week, and completely forgot to do. There are zodiacal associations to the major arcana. Like I mentioned several shows ago, I think it was back in show number two. One of the things that you can do is, as a significator for somebody, is you can find their zodiacal card and use that as their significator. But what I like to do and what I was taught is to look at the forces surrounding them. After you've shuffled your cards and after you've laid out the spread, and after you've done the interpretation of the spread, pick up the remaining cards in your deck and go through and find the card that represents their astrological sign, and then look at the card immediately preceding and the one immediately following. And this will tell you the forces surrounding that person. Two of the cards tonight, the Lovers and the Hierophant, have relations to the astrological signs. The Hierophant represents Taurus, and if you think about how Tauruses are, and they're bullheaded, and they tend to be really, really stubborn, and they want you to stick with what they know, that's pretty much what the Hierophant represents. Gemini is represented by, who else? The Lovers, because Gemini has a dual nature, and the Lovers have a dual nature. So you have that relationship as well. More than that, though, I wanted to mention these astrological associations so that y'all could start thinking about these, because in every single book I've ever seen, starting with the Merlin Tarot, which was one of the first decks I started learning on, the relationship to the astrological sign is very, very important. The association is made deliberately. And it's not done just because they can. It's done because those cards actually represent the way the person is. For instance, the Hierophant, like I was saying, is, you know, this is the way it is, and this is the way it always will be. And that's, you know, how Taurus is actually like. Leo is represented by strength, I mean, because of the big lion. You have somebody there that has quite a lot of willpower and somebody that, you know, is, well, I'm perfect, aren't you? And why don't you worship me? And that's exactly what the strength card is. And look for those associations, because not only can you do the surrounding influences, not only can you use them as significators, but there's a spread that I'm going to talk about later. I don't know if it's going to be tonight because it is an extremely complex spread called the astrological spread. That one uses every single card in the deck. You deal it out like it was a natal chart and interpret the stacks of cards based on the house that the cards fall in. And so then you start looking for, well, where is Aries? Is it in the house of Aries or is it in the house of Sagittarius? Well, what does that mean? And, you know, you can start looking at those kinds of associations. Any time that you have cards that you want to study more in depth, one of the things that I found that was really good to do is to spend time meditating just on that card. Lay it out in front of you. Look at the artwork in detail. Look at other cards that are the same card, just in different decks. Hold that image of that card in your mind and meditate. You know, just clear your mind, think only of that card, and find out what that card means to you. I've said this many times before, that the cards, the tarot cards, are a language of symbols, and that your subconscious communicates in symbols. It is theorized amongst some who deal with tarot all the time that as we shuffle the cards, we unconsciously arrange them into an order that we need to have them in order to interpret them in a reading. I realize that that's giving far too much credit to some people, especially me, but it's theorized that that's one of the things that we do magically. That's one of the reasons that the energy is there and it flows into the cards while we're shuffling them and while we're laying them out, is that subconscious arrangement. And the reason that we do that is so that the subconscious can communicate with us through the cards and tell us in a language it's familiar with, the language of symbols, what we need to see in the reading. Okay? Let's see. I just got a very large book called The Complete Book of Tarot Spreads. You may have remembered 2 weeks ago that I ordered this online, and it just got here today. And I've been paging through while I've been talking and looking at some of the spreads that they've got. And it seems to be variations on a theme. Typically, these spreads are under 10 cards. There are a few that are more than that. Some of them are, you know, very large and complex spreads. But every single one of them has a commonality in that the first card is usually the card that defines the scope of the question or the scope of the reading. When you go into a reading, one of the things that you want to do is you want to ask a question as specifically as possible. But unfortunately, us being us, we can't put enough nuance into the question while we're shuffling the card to get a very specific answer. Some people try and they hedge it around with this, that, and the other. And in my experience, that tends to confuse the situation more than it clarifies. So you want to ask things like, one of the examples that I give when I'm doing a spread is if you ask a question like, will I have money? Well, you're going to get a very positive response, mainly due to the fact that, do you have a job? Well, of course you're going to have money. You get a paycheck, don't you? So you want to ask something along the lines of, will I have the money that I need to pay this bill by this date? That's a specific question. Now, even with that, you could not put enough nuance in there, because if you get paid with your paycheck just before that bill comes due, you have the money. Now, it could be that there's five other bills that are impending and that that paycheck is spent on those other bills, but still you've got the money. It's in your hand. You can pay that bill if you want. So that's another, you know, the cards want direction. They want an area to look at, but they can get very, very distracted by exactness. So you want to leave a little wiggle room in there, but you want to give enough of a direct question that the cards aren't having to guess what you're reading for. So the first card in most readings defines the reading. It defines the question. It defines what the reading is answering. For instance, I'm looking at a spread called Separating and Bonding. It's a three-card spread. It's three cards laid out left to right, one, two, three. The very first card put down is, this is what I will be rid of, okay? And when you talk about getting rid of influences, if you were doing this spread, it would be to find out what influences you need to get rid of and what you need to draw into your life. This would not be a divinatory reading so much as a magical reading and a way of doing a tarot spell, which I'll talk about a little bit more later in this hour, I'm sure. And the number two card is, this is what I will take care of. And the last card is, this is what I will accomplish. And this one I would use, believe it or not, that's the entire reading and the entire description. It says separating and bonding. It has a picture of the three cards, and it has one, two, and three. And that's it. No explanation. So I guess you're expected to put your own explanation on some of these readings.
And that makes sense, though. I mean, realistically, every layout, regardless of what cards are supposed to mean, is going to be reflected in your own interpretation. And I think that's another reason that you go to someone to have a reading done, is because it's allowing someone else to sort of take a look at your situation and give you some suggestions, advice, you know, based on the cards that are laid, that, you know, you can maybe see things in a different or, you know, fresh way from what you're interpreting them to be.
And, yeah, and that's important, because there's a lot of times when you have when you need a fresh eye on a situation. That's why we tend to talk to our friends when we have problems, talk to our partners, because we can get so involved and so caught up in looking at the situation from our perspective that we don't see other options, and you get blinders on. So getting a second opinion, getting a fresh pair of eyes on the situation, that usually tends to help even more define the scope of the situation. Because I know in some problems that I've had in my life, I've gotten so bogged down in simply dealing with the situation right now that I can't make plans to take care of it a week from now. I can't start making choices at this moment to put myself in a better position a month from now, because I can't see that long term. I'm so tired dealing with the right now that the future is like, okay, screw the future. I'm going to deal with it right now and deal with what I'm going through. And you fall into that rut and you never actually work on getting out of it. So having somebody else look at the situation and go, okay, this is what's happening. This is how it's happening. This is why it is happening. And these are the choices that led up to this point. It helps immensely. It's a question of, oh, and I just did it again. I lost my train of thought. It's a question of managing to get an objective perspective rather than a subjective one. And that's so important to getting any problem solved. Let's see, there are... Oh, well, look at that. Major arcana and the astrological signs. Aries is the emperor. Really, okay. Taurus is the Hierophant. Gemini is the lovers. Cancer is the chariot. Leo is strength. Virgo is the hermit. Libra is justice, which is what I would expect it to be. But Scorpio is death, which is, yeah, that's right. Sagittarius is temperance. Capricorn is the devil. Aquarius is the star. And Pisces is the moon. Now, these are, according to the Golden Dawn. Well, wait a second. No, apparently not. The Golden Dawn originally transposed the major cards 8 and 9, which since has been adapted to many other tarot variations, such as the Waite Tarot. So 8 and 9 is strength. Oh, okay. All right. What they're talking about is that it shows Leo as strength, but out next to it they have the number of the card, and they have 8/9, which is why they were doing that. Okay, so that makes sense. But yeah, if for some reason, say, Aries does not strike you as the Emperor, don't be afraid to say, okay, well, for me and in my reading and in my interpretation, this doesn't resonate for me, because I've been taught that Aries is actually the sun, and that's how it comes up in my readings. If I need to know about the Aries sign in a reading or in a magical spell using the tarot cards, I use the sun because that is the holy child, the sacred child, the newness. Aries is the first sign. So you would think about, you know, a baby in that progression. And the sun has a baby riding on the back of an animal on it. And so, you know, that is not wrong. As a matter of fact, my wife and I, we have a major difference of opinion. she taught me when I was learning the tarot that the 8 and the 3 of Pentacles are opposite of each other. We'll get into this when we actually talk about the 8 of Pentacles, but we have already touched on the 3 of Pentacles, which is the Master Craftsman. Well, she taught me that the 3 of Pentacles was the Apprentice Craftsman, which in every single deck I've ever seen is actually the 8 of Pentacles. So she swaps those two. And the 8 of Pentacles becomes the Master Craftsman, and the Apprentice Craftsman is the 3 of Pentacles for her. And her cards read that way, and anytime she needs the Apprentice, the 3 comes up, and anytime she needs the Master, the 8 comes up, even though in every other interpretation in the world that I've ever seen, the 3 is the Master.
Just pressing the point there.
And the 8 is the Apprentice.
Well, you know, and that's so, just it, too. I think when I look at the two cards as, you know, individual cards, I tend to look at the 8 of Pentacles as kind of that, you know, 8 practice runs of whatever you're doing. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of how you learn. Whereas the Master's already gone through all that rough stuff, so he knows how to craft what he wants and therefore needs to only make a few of them.
Exactly. But her, one of her decks of cards a long time ago started reading, and the artwork showed her that the 8 was the Master and the 3 was the Apprentice, because apparently the 3 of Pentacles was showing a youngish person who was carving new carvings, and the 8 was manufacturing gold discs. So you can see the dichotomy there and understand the transposition. Well, she carried that because that's how she associated it in her brain and how her subconscious started associating it. Now every single deck that she picks up, including mine, when she's reading it, if she needs the Apprentice, the 3 comes up every time. And it's incredible because I can be, you know, sitting here with my Robin Wood deck and I'm shuffling and I deal and I need the Master to come up. And the 3 comes up, and I'm interpreting it as the Master. And then she picks up the same deck. I mean, collects the card, shuffles it herself, and she needs the Apprentice to come up, and there's the 3 of Pentacles. And it's incredible. It's happened so many times, and it's just always well, wait a second, that was the master in the last reading. And it's like, yeah, but we transpose those and it reads that way for her. So I don't know. It's one of those frustrating things.
Intriguing, actually.
Yeah, it is. It really, really is. But that's how magic works. I mean, as long as you have a deep and sustaining belief and you understand the symbols needed, because let's face it, anything that you're doing magically, anything you're doing with oracular interpretations or scrying or anything like that is in the realm of the will and in the realm of the ooey-ooey stuff, the higher brain, okay? Well, that's where the subconscious is at, okay? The subconscious deals in symbols all the time. That's why you dream, okay? A dream is nothing more than your subconscious taking the events of the day and indexing it in a language of symbols that it can understand. That's all it is. But when you dream, you get all these weird random symbols showing up for no particular reason. But when you start thinking about those symbols and think about what happened during your day, you start seeing the relation to them. That's why you'll walk into a room and smell baking bread and suddenly think of a toy that you had when you were five, which makes no sense to most people. But when they realize that that toy was important to them and they were sitting on the kitchen floor playing with it so their mother could watch them while she was baking bread, there's your representation. There's your attachment. And that's how your brain has indexed that memory.
Well, definitely. And I mean, scent is one of the most powerful connections to memory that we have.
Mm-hmm. And that was just an example, but I mean, that happens constantly. And you'll come up with a memory that you have no reason, no understanding why it's there, but that's because that's how your brain has indexed it. That's why we fall off on tangents when we talk, because we'll think of something and an association will be made and we'll be talking about something else and we'll get off onto this tangent and suddenly we're, you know, 5 minutes later we started off talking about Star Wars and now suddenly we're into string theory. You know, and have no clue how we got there.
Conversations like that.
Oh, yeah. I have conversations like that all the time. But when you actually start thinking about the chain of the conversation and the associations made, you understand perfectly how you got off onto that tangent. Same thing with magic. Same thing with subconscious. Same thing with tarot cards. Okay? There is an association there made in the subconscious between this concept and this symbol. The tarot shows you very plainly what that association is, okay? A wrench laying there on the floor in one of the tarot cards doesn't necessarily mean mechanical ability. It can mean bloody murder. If you have associated a wrench to the wrench that you had in Clue, where you use the pipe wrench to kill somebody. If that's your association, that wrench is always going to mean bloody murder to you. This is why 90% of I can't stand dream interpretation books, and I really don't like them simply due to the fact that they'll come up with this common list of symbols that have absolutely nothing to do with anything that I relate those symbols to.
Well,
I mean,
I think that's fair, though, because, I mean, there are only certain ideas, concepts that become archetypal, whereas there's a lot of other symbols that are just totally relevant to individuals alone.
Mm-hmm. But when you have a dog in a reading or as a symbol in, say, tea leaves, it doesn't necessarily mean loyalty and fidelity to everybody. If the person that you're reading for was attacked by a dog and their face was ripped off when they were a child, I mean, that's not going to mean fidelity and loyalty. That's going to mean absolute bloody terror.
Yeah,
and
for
pain,
sure.
You know, so you can't go by somebody else's interpretations of your symbols. This is why you have to sit down with the tarot deck. This is why you have to go through it. This is why you have to look at the symbols and meditate on them and figure out what these mean to you and what the association is. And the easiest way to do that is to take the card, look at the artwork, internalize that artwork, and then sit down and clear your mind of everything and let your brain, your subconscious, supply what those pictures mean to you. That is the entire point of this. Okay, that is how you progress from an apprentice tarot reader who's looking at the book, who's taking the dog on the moon card and associating it with, you know, loyalty and kindness and companionship, and understand that in this instance, it's something that's to be avoided at all costs. Okay, that's where you progress from being somebody that is using, speak of the moon, somebody that's using the tarot as a crutch and actually make it into an oracular tool for you. Okay, and that I can't stress this enough. This sitting down with your cards, this working with the cards and trying to figure out what they mean is cannot be avoided, not if you want to progress with it. If you're working with the tarot with spells, you also can't avoid this, because a spell is simply another language of symbols. Okay, when you have the whole purpose of a spell is to take your will, what you want to happen, and project it onto the universe. Okay, in some cases, it's you are magnetizing yourself to the situations so that you will get what you want by becoming a magnet for a new job, okay? But in any case, it is you having a desire for a new job and taking a process to bring that job to you, okay? With the tarot, as the spell tool, what you do is you find the symbols that represent job to you in the tarot deck. And there's about 36 cards that in various ways can represent job or the end point of having a job, success, financial gain, a satisfied home, whatever. And you lay those out in a way that makes sense to you, so it tells a story, or so that it will magnetize you to that situation. But once again, you are projecting your willpower on the universe to bring you that job. Okay? And that's how you use the tarot for spells. Because I know people sit down with spell books and chant things and burn incense and sprinkle powders and light candles and think that that's going to bring them a job. And that's a way of doing it. But if you're just going through the motions like that, it's not going to do anything. Because primarily, what you have to do is you have to put your desire for that into the spell in order to bring those to you. Now, doing that is fine. You can do that without any tools, without any ritual, without any chanting, without any moving around and eating bugs or anything like that, okay? You can do that simply by the force of your will, all right? Using the chants and everything is reinforcing it for your subconscious. That's what all of those tools and all of those symbols and all of those items that you're using during the spell process are doing. They are reinforcing it so that your entire brain is working for it, not just your conscious brain, okay? Because you have your conscious, your subconscious, and your superconscious. Your superconscious is your intuition. That is connected to the universe. It is the still small voice inside of you that tells you that you're doing something wrong or that you're doing something counter to what you should be doing. It is the voice that will never, ever screw you over. That is always working for your best benefit. Your subconscious is the part that is the storehouse for everything. It is the sum total of your entire existence, and not only that, but all of your past existences as well. Okay? Your conscious mind is the boundary line between the superconscious and the subconscious. Okay? It is the combination of not only the storehouse, but also the connection to everything and your intuition. Okay? When you go to sleep, your superconscious shuts off. Okay? It shuts down because it needs rest. It takes an awful lot of work to be connected to everything and to be constantly planning and looking ahead and trying to figure out what's going on. So it shuts down, which leaves the subconscious with nothing to do except run around making you see purple elephants dancing in tutus while on the ceiling, and then there's a music video being shot at the same time. And you have no reason for that to be happening, but you dream stuff like that, and you know you do. I do. Everybody does. So it runs around, and it's associating things, and it's storing everything, and it's coming up with all kinds of insane crud, which is why you're asleep. Because this is the time for it to organize itself. Speaking of tangents, we just got off on a huge one. I was talking about spells, and I was talking about how to use the language of the symbols in the tarot cards to use those spells. Okay, once you know what the various symbols in the tarot mean to you, you can consciously pull those symbols out and talk to your subconscious directly with the tarot, or with, you know, whatever spell casting tools you need, to get the subconscious cooperating with your conscious mind and your superconscious mind to bring the fulfillment of the spell to you. Because in most cases, what happens is we sit there and we'll chant the chant and we'll burn the incense, and the only thing that is trying to bring that spell to fruition is your conscious mind. Well, as I said, that's just this thin little line, this little border between the two. If you manage to meditate on it, you can get your superconscious cooperating, okay? But you've got this entire region of your mind, the whole subconscious, that is not only not caring, it's running around being insane like a Tasmanian devil, just bouncing off walls and whatever. And that's not focused on what you're trying to accomplish. In fact, it might be you know, working against you. But if you manage to catch its attention with symbols that it understands, a job in the Three of Pentacles, with the Ten of Pentacles, with the financially happy home, and you say, okay, this is what we are going for. Three of Wands, Ten of Pentacles, money, good job, and lots of money, financially sound home. The subconscious will understand that and start cooperating with you. And you, the power and energy and the willpower in your spell goes from, say, 1% of the total to 89%. And it's just an amazing jump. It's almost, you know, my brain is running so fast because there's so many things I want to say right now that my mouth can't keep up. So I'm starting to stutter. It's just the level of change when you get your subconscious working with the rest of the spell is stupefying in so many ways. And that's what the spell process is. So anytime you do a spell, it has to make sense to not only your conscious mind, but also to your subconscious mind. And this is one of the basic lessons in Wicca, in paganism, whenever you're working with spells, whenever you're working with ritual, is learning that language of symbols and making sure that your subconscious understands that language of symbols. Ritual is hard because the rituals sometimes don't have any relation to what you're doing. And I speak specifically on some of the rituals that have been published. I don't know how accurate they are because nobody will confirm them. On some of the Gardnerian Sabbats, where you chant Evo Echo, and you say this five times, and then you wave this your athame in a pentagram, and you say these Latin words. Okay,
well,
that's great. That's great for then, but if you don't understand the meaning behind them, you're not getting all. You're just getting your conscious mind into it. You're not getting your superconscious mind into it. You're not getting your subconscious mind into it. That's where the tarot comes in really strongly, because it's nothing but symbols.
Well, I think too that the Gardnerian rituals, particularly that particular chant that you're talking about, actually is drawn really heavily from ceremonial magic. So, in fact.
Sure.
Well,
and I'm sure part of the process of learning the Gardnerian rituals is having it explained by the practitioners what they mean, so that it does make sense.
Well,
and you know,
those particular
ahead.
First words actually are the four Hebrew letters of the Tetragrammaton, the unpronounceable name of God, mm-hmm. Yod Heh Vav Heh. But they've sort of degenerated from the formal pronunciation in Hebrew to something similar that provides the same result, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I was just, you know, I was stressing because one of the things that we had, you and I had discussed, adding into here is working with the tarot in your spells. So
yeah, for
that's
sure.
That's the dissertation on tarot and spells. you know, the books are great for a starting point. They're wonderful for understanding what the symbols could mean. They're wonderful for a cheat sheet to start with. Because, you know, a book of dreams where it's talking about the dog is loyalty, for 90% of humanity, that's what they associate a dog with. So it's a good starting point, but with anything, with any symbol like this, you're going to have to find out the specifics for the people that you're dealing with. If you throw down the moon card and it's got the dog on there, and you know the dogs represent loyalty, and you say, okay, you've got somebody that's very loyal to you in your life, and then you point specifically to the dog and say, then that's represented by the dog here on the moon, and they say, well, I hate dogs. Then you know that in this case, it's quite possible that the dog is not representing loyalty, it's representing terror. Especially when you realize that the moon is at night, there's a wolf there's water there that you could drown in. I mean, the moon card could become go from being secrets to being a nightmare.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, one of the things, too, that, like, one of the cards that everyone misinterprets, like, desperately, and the one that I think creates a lot of the fear that people have of the tarot overall, is the death card.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and traditionally that's representative of a drastic change in your life that's for the good. It's like the old dying away, the new coming into being.
The perfect interpretation that I give to the death card is the metamorphosis of the chrysalis. Because
yeah,
you go into
sure.
it as a caterpillar, you start off as, you know, this thing, and you metamorphosize in the chrysalis over time into a butterfly. One of the most poignant statements that I ever saw in any book was by Richard Bach. It's called Illusions. In there it says, what the caterpillar calls the end of the world, the master calls the butterfly.
Yeah,
because
for
that's,
sure.
You know, and that's perfect for the death card, because it is a natural progression from one state to another, and it is a death of the first state. It is an ending, but it is a continuation on into another one.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. And the, I mean, the whole notion of that symbolic death and resurrection comes up in any sort of rite of passage that you may go through as well.
Oh, yeah.
Change of, you know, life. You know, I mean,
initiation.
Death card. Yeah, the death card definitely could represent any number of situations. Menopause, you know, puberty, anything like that. I mean, hell, graduation, if that's something that someone's striving for.
And it can actually represent death itself. I mean, because if you stop and think about it, if you believe in reincarnation, the body dies, but the soul and the spirit continues on afterwards. It's a metamorphosis from a living state to a energy state, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
But because we as a society have been trained to fear what we can't see, smell, hear, and touch, we fear death. We fear what's beyond it. And I lay the blame for most of that directly at the door of the misinterpretation of the tenets of Christianity. Because, yes, the Christian belief says that you're rewarded or punished after you are dead, but more than that, you should live your life as if you were going to die any minute. Not to get the reward, not to fear the punishment, but to be the best person that you possibly can be. And that's the point. But it was misinterpreted into fear the death because you will then be judged on your life. And then the reward comes after death, or after your body ceases to exist and your soul goes on. And then there's no redemption after that.
I think
people are scared of it.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think, too, that the whole notion of that that dualistic afterlife mindset comes actually from the Egyptian religions where, you know, you're in the process of your soul heading toward the afterlife. You have to meet up with the guy who weighs
Maat.
Your heart against the feather of truth.
Maat.
Is it really?
Yes. Well, Anubis escorts you there. Maat is the one that weighs your heart against the feather.
Okay, fair enough. And I mean, if your heart is found heavier due to sins, you know, however they interpret them in Egypt, then your soul is basically cast off to the devourer, and then, you know, game over kind of thing. There's no chance that you're going to ever resurrect again.
Well, one of the things that I actually came to through a lot of work and trying to understand is, while all of that's true, think about the situation. Here you are, a being that is going to school, essentially, because that's what life is pretty much like. It's going to school. You have the time that you're in school where you're concentrated on school, you're focused on school, you're learning lessons, you're doing your homework, you're getting tested, and then you go on summer vacation, okay? And then you're out of school for 3 months. Well, is that not a death of the school life? And a time of contemplation after school is over with, so that you can integrate what you learned while you were in school into yourself before moving on and building on those in the next grade. That's pretty much what reincarnation is you're in school, you're learning things, you're getting tested, your body dies. Your soul continues on and takes the lessons that it learned while it had a body, integrates those into the soul, and then moves on to another lifetime where it builds on what you just learned.
Yeah.
Now, once you get that point, say you've been reincarnated 5,000 times, and you are, you know, your soul, the part that's on summer vacation, is tired. They're tired of living more lifetimes. They're tired of having being required to live more lifetimes because they haven't learned all of the lessons they're supposed to. And yet here they are. They come in. They're in front of Ma'at. He's weighing your heart and says, no, you still have more lessons to learn.
And that's very possible. I mean, I haven't really spent much time with Egyptian mythology as much as I have with, like, Greek or
But saying that, you know, that would be, to me and to my mind, getting told that, no, you have to go do it again is one of the worst things that could possibly happen at that point.
Well, that's definitely true, and I think that sort of falls along more of the Buddhist approach to death. It's amazing the tangent we've gone on to just because of a card. but, yeah, I mean, like, I think the Buddhist approach to the afterlife is that you build a certain stock of karma for the next life, and it's from the karma that you build in this life that your next life unfolds. So if you've been an asshole your entire life, this life caused pain and suffering and misery and whatever, in the next life, you're going to live in a degraded situation.
And you're going to suffer yourself.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that this concept of punishment or reward after your body ceases reoccurs in every single major religion. I can't think of any religion that I know of, and believe me, I haven't studied all of them, but I've studied a lot of them, where a concept similar to this, not exactly the same thing, but similar to, doesn't exist. It exists in Christianity. It exists in Buddhism. It exists in Hinduism. It exists in Egyptian. It exists in Kemetic, in Jewish. In every case, it is a time where you have a period after you're dead, after your body ceases to function, where you can contemplate what you learned and integrate it and get rewarded or punished.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, the reward and punishment doesn't come from a deity or an entity that's outside of ourselves. It comes from inside of ourselves. Because I don't know about y'all, but if I was doing something and I know I cheated on a test, I'm not going to be going, hey, I cheated on a test, aren't I wonderful? I'm going to be going, oh, my God, I cheated on a test. I can't believe I didn't study that stuff. I didn't do it right. I wish I knew it. I wish I didn't have to cheat. So then you get to do it again and make different choices this time. You know, so anyway. All right, it is 8:50 at this point. Anything that you had to say, Brian? I mean, other than the tangent that we went off on here.
I think the tangents are good, especially since our callers are not calling in. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it's basically a point of mentioning to people that I've kind of discontinued Saturday shows. I decided not to do Witching Hour Wednesdays just because I kind of felt like I've been overwhelmed trying to do too many shows and fitting in my, you know, work life and, you know, other things that I want to do. So Wednesdays and Saturdays, we will not have a show for a while. There might be an occasional show if I kind of arrange an interview with someone or, you know, just decide to post a show that we get to chill with someone interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, stay tuned for the tarot talk on Tuesday nights. We're going to keep doing that.
And anytime we have a situation like we did last week where either Brian or I are just out of it and you know, life has intruded and we can't do anything, we're going to announce that on Tumblr. We're also going to, I would assume, put up a notification on the Tarot Talk website at Blogspot or what, blogtalk.com?
Yeah,
okay.
blogtalkradio.com/woodwolves.
Yeah, and I will make it a point to put an announcement up on Aaron's journal as well, just so that people know that, hey, there's not going to be a show tonight, but we're not canceling it. Tune in next week or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, the simple truth is that, you know, sometimes life will happen. That's unavoidable. So if it does happen, don't panic, folks. We will let you know. Woodwose-radio.tumblr.com.
And mine is wide-worlds, with an S, -joy@tumblr.com, or .tumblr.com.
And if you want to email the show to find out, like, what cards we're going to be discussing the following week or what have you, woodwose.radio@yahoo.ca.
joy.a.philip, no S, @gmail.com.
So, yeah, I mean, don't be afraid to ask us questions. You know, if there's something that you find in your tarot deck that you kind of want to question us about, or that
confuses
maybe
you.
You have a point that, or, you know, or even something that you totally interpret differently that we're, you know, that you feel is leading, we're leading you guys totally off of. Or if you have a different tarot deck than we're talking about, you know, because, I mean, I look at my own tarot decks and I'm finding the names and symbols in each card are different, but overall, you know, the general ideas there for the traditional interpretations. But yeah, I mean, that's not to say that you don't see something differently. So by all means, question us, challenge us, point out your own opinions on things. Help.
And in order to do all of this, you have to participate with us. You have to actually come on to the chat room and talk to us. We don't bite, okay? You know, come talk to us. Send us emails. Call the show. I mean, I'd love to talk to somebody and to hear what your opinions on something are. I'd like this to become an interactive show instead of just me pontificating for 2 hours with Brian occasionally popping in with something.
Exactly.
I love hearing myself talk, but it's so much better when there's somebody to talk to and there's somebody to interact with and somebody that has a question, because that leads me to a deeper understanding of what I'm doing myself.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I think that's probably it for tonight. I mean, it's not the full 2 hours, but it's probably close enough.
Yeah, and I was thinking, actually, I just played Dave the Bard's Willow's Song. If you're familiar with the Wicker Man, Willow is the bartender's daughter who tries to seduce the cop into losing his virginity so that he doesn't become a sacrificial victim. So, yeah, Willow's Song is one of my favorites from the movie. This is Dave the Bard's version of it, so enjoy. Good night, folks. Talk to you later.
All right. Y'all have a good time.
Night, Joy.
Take care.
You too.